libertarians are actually, in personality, very much like liberals, not like conservatives, very much like liberals, but just lower in compassion and just... When I was in my 20s, I briefly wanted to be a comedian and perform in places like this, but I didn't have the guts. And now this is such a cool venue, and I know you're all gonna like laugh at my jokes, and I can see from the smiles on your face, it's a very positive audience, and I actually don't have to risk going out and making a fool of myself. I actually get to speak about stuff that I know something about, and then if I forget what I'm gonna say, I just pretend that that's the end of my talk, and I go to discussion with John. So this is very exciting and very safe, and I hope it'll be fun. It may also trigger some other emotions, so let's go. I'm gonna start with a little quiz for you. Let's figure out who we've got here in the room. I want to take your moral temperature and figure out whether you guys support moral position A or B. I'll read you four quotes and you just see which ones you endorse. Here's the first one for moral position A. Here's a quote from, it's a quote from a philosopher writing about pederasty and homosexual relations more generally. Quote, I have been tormenting myself for years to find a possible, to find if possible, a sufficient ground for treating these acts with the severity with which they are treated at this time by all European nations. But upon the principle of utility, I can find none. He then concludes that all these sexual perversions that were punished by death and dismemberment should be legalized, permitted, that there's nothing wrong with them. That's quote A. Raise your hand if you sort of resonate, you think that, yeah, that makes sense, that sort of fits with your morality. Please raise your hand now. Okay, and raise your hand if you disagree with it. Okay. All right, now here's the first quote for position B. It's from probably the best-selling book of, let's see. Here we are. The best-selling book of recent times. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, which you have from God, and that you are not your own? Therefore, glorify God in your body. Okay, raise your hand if that expresses your morality, if you would agree with that generally. Okay. And raise your hand if you don't. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's from Corinthians. The first quote was from Jeremy Bentham. All right. Now we'll just do two more, and then we'll get a sense of who's where. Here's the second for position A. Questions of morality are questions about happiness and suffering. This is why you and I do not have obligations towards rocks. To the degree that our actions can affect the experience of other creatures positively or negatively, questions of morality apply. Raise your hand if you agree with that, if that basically fits with your morality, okay, most of you, and raise your hand if you don't. Okay, all right, here's the last quote for position B. We are repelled by the prospect of cloning human beings, not because of the strangeness or novelty of the undertaking, but because we intuit and feel immediately and without argument the violation of things that we rightfully hold dear. Repugnance, here as elsewhere, revolts against the excesses of human willfulness, warning us not to transgress what is unspeakably profound. Indeed, in this age in which everything is held to be permissible so long as it is freely done, in which our given human nature no longer commands respect, in which our bodies are regarded as mere instruments of our autonomous rational wills, repugnance may be the only voice left that speaks up to defend the central core of our humanity. Shallow are the souls that have forgotten how to shudder. Okay, raise your hand if you agree with that, if that's your morality. Okay, so I think we have a pretty clear sense that position A wins. So position A was Bentham, and that last quote before was Sam Harris. So raise your hand if you generally endorse position A. Things aren't wrong if they don't hurt people, et cetera. Raise your hand high. Okay. And raise your hand if you endorse position B. That's the Bible and Leon Cass. Raise your hand. What, a half. Okay. Julian, what was my prediction? I predicted it'd be 90% Bentham, 10% Cass, but I guess I was wrong. It's like 95% Bentham, and then a half will be whatever. So now these two positions are a, you can think of them really as a dimension of social cognition. I call it the Bentham-Cass dimension. It runs from Jeremy Bentham and perfect utilitarianism on one side to Leon Cass, the sort of conservative philosopher. He was the head of Bush's bioethics panel on the other. And people fall along this distribution, and we'll talk about that distribution, but this is what I would call not a representative sample of America. Okay, now when I say it's a dimension of social cognition, think of it this way. Our brains evolved to perceive physical space in three dimensions. It's not something we had to learn from our families. Like all animals, you know, a horse is born, and on the day it's born, it can walk around, doesn't bump into things. So our brains process space in three dimensions. We get that intuitively. In the same way, our minds process social space in three dimensions. The first dimension is a horizontal dimension of closeness or solidarity, is what sociologists call it. All over the world, people make distinctions between those who are close and far away. Your family is close, strangers are far. Your friends are close, your enemies are far. So we just think about people, are they close to me or far from me? Society will affect how you use that, but that is deep and innate. You find it in every culture. Then there's a vertical dimension of hierarchy. People have a sense of who's above and below. Now, there are egalitarian cultures that actively suppress it, but it's there and they have to actively suppress it. Culture, again, will matter. It can play it up or down, but human minds all over the world perceive this vertical dimension. If you've ever studied French or Spanish or any Romance language, you know that they have to go through these contortions to recognize those two dimensions. And you use tu versus vu to mark both closeness on the horizontal dimension and being at your level or below on the vertical dimension. So those two dimensions must be marked. In English, you'd think our language doesn't do it, but our minds do it, and that forces us to find a substitute. So that awkwardness of do you address somebody by Mr. Smith, or do you call them Bob, whatever, the rules for when we do that, they follow exactly the social rules in France and Spain and other places for switching from tu to vu. So it's not just in our languages. Excuse me? The and thou. There you go. So English used to do it. It lost it, but it's retained it in the form of Mr. or title last name. So those two dimensions are clear and simple. Everyone understands those. I've been studying morality for about 25 years now, and I got interested in these aspects of morality that nobody was studying, the aspects of morality when you read the Bible, you read ethnographies of other cultures, and all over the world, it's not just about stealing and killing and honesty. Morality is often about menstruation and food and sex and who you're having sex with and how you handle corpses. And I thought this was very strange, and nobody in psychology was talking about this. So I was reading a lot of anthropology, and I spent a few months in India doing interviews, doing some field work there. And the conclusion I came to is that all over the world, it's actually, the psychology is so similar. It's a kind of a vertical dimension of divinity. Now here, I've already given you a vertical dimension, so you gotta go to three dimensions. You know, X-axis, Y-axis, and then a Z-axis coming out of the wall, let's say. So imagine social space is a three-dimensional space, and this third dimension is divinity. In many cultures, the idea is that God is at the top, the devil or demons are at the bottom, humans are in the middle, some humans are higher than others. Not in hierarchy, but in virtue, purity, sanctity, closeness to God. The whole Catholic architecture of saints and sainthood is very similar to what you find in, you know, in Hinduism with levels of purity and reincarnation. So it's three dimensions of social space, and there's huge variation in whether you perceive this third dimension. And my guess is that many of the people in this room largely don't, or at least they minimize it. This third dimension is the absolute key to understanding why sex is such a big deal to most of the world, why they moralize all these things that don't hurt anybody. So let me just tell you a little bit about this dimension. If you understand it, then you'll understand so much of the culture war stuff. You know, I've heard so many people over the last 5 or 10 years say, I just don't understand why they care about gay marriage. I can't even get it. Like, are they crazy? It makes no sense. If you ever find yourself thinking that, probably it's because it's a moral issue that is arrayed along this vertical dimension of divinity, and you're not seeing that. So I'll just say a little bit about that, and where it comes from, and then I will give you one final test to see if many of you are really zero, or maybe you're like one on a scale of 0 to 10. I'll see if I can move you up a little bit. So why do we have this? Well, actually, Baba gave a great introduction to it. We humans have a lot of social evolution. We are ultra-social creatures. We live in groups, very tight groups. When our ancestors came down out of the trees, lived on the ground in very dense groups, suddenly parasites and exchanging microbes is much more serious than when you live in small groups that are largely arboreal. Then we begin also, we didn't go to hunter-gathering early, we first went to scavenging. We actually ate meat off of carcasses, which is very disease-ridden. So we're exposing ourselves to vast numbers of new toxins, but as our diet is improving, our brains are getting bigger, we have the capacity to keep track of things that no other animal can keep track of, like the history of something, what it touched before you got it. So the emotion of disgust emerges as this uniquely human emotion that guards our mouths. Think of disgust as a guardian of the mouth, like a sentinel there at your mouth. When I was studying disgust, we were working with a Japanese guy, and he brought in honey-covered grasshoppers from Japan. And I was, I was a young disgust researcher, and I said, okay, I'm going to eat one. I was working with my advisor, Paul Ross, and we were going to eat one. And I made my hand go out, and I made my hand pick one up, and I made my hand bring it, and as soon as it got there, I gagged. It was like there was a sentinel there that I couldn't control that prevented me from doing it. Now, I then took my other hand, and once I got it past my lips, it was fine. But this is the border, right there. That's the border. And so disgust guards that border, right there. So it's adaptive, but we become more cultural and creative creatures, and as we start creating moral orders, we're weaving them out of all these other emotions and systems that we have, and so disgust expands to be not just a guardian of the mouth, but a guardian of the body more generally, and of course sex is the other big place where we're putting things into our bodies, we're exposing ourselves to vast numbers of microbes and bacteria. So disgust expands from a guardian of the mouth to being a guardian of the body more generally. And then from there, it's just ready-made to become a guardian of the social and moral order, because anger makes us want to punish or kill or use force. Disgust makes us want to close off and separate. And there are many social problems which that's appropriate. When people have bad ideas, communism, ideas that are treated as threats, we use disgust and we're afraid that they're going to contaminate our children. We're totally focused on our children. Many societies, every society I've studied, whatever emotional words they use to describe cockroaches and dirty stuff, they also begin to use that to describe moral violations that don't involve the body. So we're a creative, symbolic species, and we begin to use disgust to structure our moral worlds. And this is the case for all of human history. Until really the 20th century, it begins to fade out a little bit. I have a whole collection of sex manuals, not for personal edification, but for scholarly purposes, I assure you. And there are all these advice books from 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you know, advice to young men about to get married, because of course they're assumed to know nothing about sex. Are there some of those books here in the museum? There must be a section of books on sex in the Victorian era is really interesting. Turn to the section on masturbation, and what you'll always find up until the 1920s is all this language of degradation and impurity and pollution. And then in the 20s, a hygienic view begins to come in. We get mass market consumerism, we get rising wealth, we get rising individualism. So the world that we live in is the first, it's been called the first fully desacralized world ever devised by human beings. Modern, Western, wealthy, educated people live in a world in which disgust plays a much lower role than it does throughout human history and across cultures. So that's the sort of the biological and cultural history of how we got to the point where we could have a museum of sex. I mean, that was not really conceivable, I would imagine, until fairly recently. Now, I just want to briefly say a little bit more about this. This trait, this both disgust sensitivity and then the tendency to use that to structure your morality, it varies a lot by individuals, like every trait. Some people are high on it, some are low. And my colleagues and I and other researchers have done research to measure disgust sensitivity. And what we find is that people who are low on it tend to be attracted to liberalism or libertarianism, as Baba was saying. People who are high on it tend to be conservative. Also, if you disgust people or you activate ideas of disgust, they get more conservative and they get more homophobic. So there's clearly a link between your disgust sensitivity and your moral judgment about culture war issues. We've shown that experimentally and correlationally. Now, political groups differ quite a lot on this. Libertarians are... You know, of course, the sort of the forgotten, I mean, you guys have a right to be annoyed, on all these surveys, where are you on a 1-7 scale, liberal to conservative? No, I'm not on the scale. What my group has found is that libertarians are actually, in personality, very much like liberals, not like conservatives, very much like liberals, but just lower in compassion and just... more rational. You guys, libertarians are the smartest, most logical, least emotional across all emotions. So there's a sort of a general personality similarity, which is why we all hang out together. Liberals and libertarians are always hanging out together, but they end up often voting differently because they have different views about social policy, but they're all very low on disgust. Actually, libertarians are even lower than liberals. They're the lowest on disgust sensitivity. It varies, this trait varies across cultures. As I was saying, I did some work in India where it's really woven into the laws and the social fabric, and it varies across historical eras. So. Once you begin to see this, we sort of judge people, or not maybe not people here in this room, but most people judge people based on what they do with their bodies, how saintly or godlike they are versus how animal or degraded or debased they are. I'm hoping to give you this tool so that now you go out in the world and you look at other people almost like a zoologist saying, oh, now that I understand that they have these scent glands that other animals don't have, I see why those conservatives are believing this or that or that. So, and it's not just conservatives. Liberals also have this to some extent. It's really libertarians who are the lowest on this. Again, it's part of being the most rational, just straightforward, logical, not perceiving magical essences the way that most people do. So before we turn this over to, to John and then to all of you, I just want to end with a sort of a harder test to pass. Let's just see if you guys really are all Benthamites. I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and I want you to vote. After each question, you can either say yes for totally okay, morally ambivalent, or morally wrong. Okay? So let's start. Birth control that prevents conception. Raise your hand if you think that's totally okay, perfectly okay. Raise your hand if you're morally ambivalent. And raise your hand if you think it's wrong. Okay. So everyone agrees on that. All right, now we'll move up the scale. A chemical abortion, you know, by the pill, 1 week after conception, so it's a blastocyst, there's no nervous system, so a woman takes the morning after, or RU46, so a chemical abortion 1 week after conception. Raise your hand if it's perfectly okay. Okay, morally ambivalent, raise your hand for morally ambivalent, and raise your hand if you think that's morally wrong. Okay, so we're getting a few people beginning to peel off on that. Next, surgical abortion in month 6. Now, let's assume for the sake of argument that there's conclusive proof that at that age, the nervous system, while it is largely in place, assume there's conclusive proof that that there's no sensation. Just assume that for the sake of this question. Abortion at 6 months when it looks like a little infant, but you can be confident that it won't feel any pain. Raise your hand if you think that's perfectly okay or that's morally okay. Raise your hand. Okay, raise your hand if you're ambivalent about it. Okay, most of you. And raise your hand if you think it's morally wrong. Okay, so now we're shifting over, but according to Bentham, a straight Benthamite calculation, if you accept that there's no suffering and that the person who chooses to do these things is going to have a much better life, they chose this after a long decision process, they are making a decision for themselves, so already we see that most of you are not actually Benthamites. Something about this is already peeling you off, and I suspect it's the Leon Cass thing, that it just feels creepy, wrong, degraded, even though you're cerebrally you know that there's no suffering. All right. Well, viability doesn't mean the same. Okay, viability is an issue. That could be an issue, certainly. But if we assume that there's no pain or suffering, that's really what Bentham is all about. Okay. All right, so now here... I know I would have gotten a different answer. That's why I didn't ask that. Okay. And now you'll see why I asked it. All right, so here's the last one. Now, I'm pretty good at making up disgusting, horrible stories, but this one is much, much worse than I could ever have imagined, and it's something apparently that philosophers talk about. It's like one of their standard cases. It's not the trolley problem. It's something a little more involved. So here's a hypothetical story. A very wealthy man wants to have sex with young girls, but but he's a utilitarian, and he would never dream of causing suffering, causing harm, causing humiliation. So he would never dream of seducing a young girl. So what he does, he buys human eggs on the open market. He has them mixed with his own sperm in a lab. He pays a lot for the eggs, pays a lot for the lab. Everyone's making money. This is great. He pays a woman a lot of money to be a from a Benthamite point of view. He pays a woman to be the carrier, the surrogate mother. At 5 months of gestation, he has a special surgeon come in, perform an operation that severs the brainstem above the middle, so that the child would be born decerebrate. In other words, no sensation, no cognition, no consciousness. It will basically be a human body. Oh, by the way, he paid to have sex selection, so he knows it's going to be a female embryo. You see where this is going. So the child is born. He has the child. He pays to have the child's body, supported. And then when it reaches the age of 13 or 14, he starts having sex with it as often as he likes. Now, if you're a Benthamite, and I didn't make this. I should watch out. Here we are. But in this building and with this crowd, this really could give some people some ideas. So my question is, raise your hand if you think this is morally okay. Okay, raise your hand if you are morally ambivalent. Okay, and raise your hand if you think this is morally wrong. Okay, so I've at least established that you guys, that even though all of you went with position A, the Benthamite position, yeah?
To be clear, are we asking whether the sex is wrong or the surgery was wrong?
Well, how could it be wrong if it feels so right? We're asking about what you think about this guy and this story. He's okay.
Now, can you talk a little bit more about what distinguishes libertarians? Because you have probably the greatest database on the libertarian personality. You've done all these surveys of people, and libertarians are low on disgust. How else do they differ? And how do they differ from liberals when it comes to disgust? Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Is this on now? No. So let's switch again. Let's see if we can get that on. So I co-run a website called YourMorals.org. We've had about 300,000 people take surveys at the website. Unlike Gallup and everybody else, we don't force people to say where they are on a 1 to 7 scale of left-right. We allow them to pick not any of them, but libertarian. And we have full personality batteries, not just a single item attitude measure. And I think the most interesting difference, the way to summarize really all the rest of the other differences, is that there are these two personality traits that Simon Baron Cohen, he's an autism researcher, but don't get upset yet. He says that the difference between men and women is prenatal testosterone changes your brain. So we all start off in utero to be girls. And then if there's a Y chromosome, there's a little bit of testosterone, that changes a bunch of aspects of the brain. One of them is it makes the brain a little bit more prone to systemizing, that is thinking about systems and modeling them, and a little less prone to empathizing. So this is the difference, the sort of the master variable difference between male and female, and also between masculine and feminine men and masculine and feminine women. And what Baron Cohen says is that when people get higher on systemizing and lower, really low on empathizing, if you go far enough, that is what he calls autism. Now, systemizing is a great strength. There's nothing bad about it at all. What we found, we took Simon Baron Cohen's measure and we gave it to people, and what we found is that first we find his sex differences, just as he says. Libertarians are by far the highest on systemizing and by far the lowest on empathizing. And that's even true within sex. If you just look at women, let's say, women who become libertarians are higher on systemizing and lower in empathizing than women who don't. And liberals and conservatives aren't actually that different on these. So this explains the great strengths of libertarians and why they do so well in academics, why they do so well in think tanks. They're very theoretical, logical, rational people. We also have some logic problems. They solve them better than anyone else. So it's a strength, but it makes it harder. Empathizing means the ability to read the emotions and feelings of other people and anticipate what they're going to do. And I presented these results at the Cato Institute, and some people thought that they were going to be very offended, but people said they were, no, yeah, that's us, yes, that's exactly what, yeah, that's cool, yeah, yeah. Okay, Jerry.
Well,
I'm sorry, we're not in. Oh, well, okay, go ahead.
Prejudicial speculation on my part, but I've wondered if your questionnaire, which I still need to take, somehow attracts a self-selected segment of libertarians, where there are different kinds of libertarians.
Yes.
There are those so-called deontological, which really care about nothing except stay the hell out of my face. Mm-hmm. But there are many others, I think most of those that are associated with think tanks, like your friend Ron Bailey, who became libertarians only because they were very compassionate about human well-being. And Ron initially was a lefty, and he went to work for government to help do good for the world. And he was smart enough to figure out that that's not a very effective way of doing good for the world. But he's driven by compassion. And my anecdotal evidence is that many of my colleagues okay. are as well.
Well, it's certainly true that libertarians look at social policy positions, and they say, my God, the liberal view is causing so much damage, and here's a way to do it much better. And they're upset that bad policies are put into place by, quote, bleeding heart liberals, people so motivated by compassion that they can't look at the effects of their actions. As for whether Ron's true motive was compassion, that is, was he just going about his business and he just kept feeling such pain, such horrible internal pain when he saw others suffering, and my God, the liberals aren't helping. What else is there? Oh, libertarianism. If that's really the causal path, then I would grant that you're right. My guess, though, is that libertarians, because they are on average, again, this is a sort of averages, there's lots of variations, so your mileage may vary. My sense is that they more come to see this intellectually, and then they realize, oh my God, these policies are actually much better at helping people.
Okay, I'm sorry. Talking about disgust, something that the people in this room have a hard time with. What uses are there of that feeling? And also, do you have any advice for how, should libertarians be trying to figure out these disgust feelings more to be able to understand?
Okay. Well, so first, from a strategic perspective, if libertarians, it's funny. I mean, so many people will endorse libertarian ideas, and if you ask them whether they're socially liberal but fiscally conservative, like most young people say that, yet there's never a libertarian party, and politically they're not as effective as they could be. So it might be that learning to empathize better and assume a virtue if you have it not, for use almost can change the stamp of nature, that might be strategically an effective way to be able to talk to people who are not dispositionally libertarian and get them to actually be involved in libertarian projects. In a less Machiavellian vein, just thinking about, does this third dimension actually do anything for us? Or is it just some atavism that we might as well just ditch? To some extent, we do need to either ditch it or at least tone it down, because it makes us believe things, like, for example, miscegenation laws. A lot of disgust is just keeping things separate. The kosher laws, you should not mix two different kinds of fiber. I mean, that's, it's this purity and purification idea, this purity and pollution idea just taken to such an extreme. So, the idea that you shouldn't let people of different races have sex, I mean, we got to get rid of all that stuff. And we did. And it was greeted by the same sort of disgust, in the South, but they got over it. And gay marriage, it's exactly the same thing. And thank God, it's really working well. So what I think is happening with gay marriage, it's not, and I get this debate from philosophers a lot who say, well, isn't it that philosophers made the arguments and ultimately reason won? And I think, no, I don't think it's the reasons. I think it's will and grace. It's when people get used to things, you see it, it's not a taboo, it's not strange, so that you lose the disgust. So to a large extent, yes, we must tone it down. The question I'm interested in is whether we should totally get rid of it, have no role for repugnance and disgust in our law, in our social policy, or whether there's a role for a little bit of it. And when I listen to Leon Cass, I've seen him give a number of talks, and when I listen to him, and he's a great writer, and he's saying something that seems noble and uplifting, and I think he's right in general, and then you put up that concern about, can't we just manipulate everything to our pleasure, you put it up against any actual policy, like say in vitro fertilization, which he was against, and then because he thought it would dehumanize our relation to our children. Well, then it turns out people did it. It makes no difference. You love your children just the same. His children had several IVF pregnancies, and he changed his mind too. So on specific issues where there are people who are really clearly victims of these policies, then I think we need to try to ditch them, and it seems we can. Now, should we end the laws against creating a baby and having sex with your own child? And Justice Scalia in his dissent, what was the key case?
Lawrence versus Texas,
right. So his dissent, he said, well, if we allow, homosexual, what's next? Incest, bestiality. To which I would say, since 5% of people are gay, that's a lot of people. And we really need to try to do something about this. The number of people who can't live a full and decent life unless they have sex with a sheep, that's not very many people. I'm content, if it does some good to have a sense that there's some morals we share, and there are a few people out there who can't be happy, I'm willing to let them be unhappy.
But it's difficult to draw these distinctions, and it causes, our country was founded on the idea that There have been different religions in Europe, and a lot of that is based on some of this sort of disgust, tribal, these sort of primal emotions, and we come up with these justifications. And so the founding fathers said, look, we're just not going to distinguish between religions. We're not going to say one is better than the other. Now, the libertarian position on so many of these issues about sex and gay marriage and things is that the government just shouldn't try to start distinguishing on these disgust things, that society may do it, and if people are repulsed by things, it'll be shunned, it'll be unpopular, but the government's not very good at making these distinctions and making legal distinctions.
Okay, right. As a practical matter, I think that is one of the great libertarian insights, that the philosophers might say, oh, well, you know, there should be some, or the policy, you know, there should be some, you know, central response, but that in practice, the history often will work out badly. Now, one of the great things about America, I think, is the federal system and the fact that very little is supposed to be decided at the federal level. Marriage policies, those shouldn't be federal. Abortion policies, those shouldn't be federal. Those should generally be at the state level. So if you're talking about federal government, yeah, I think you need to really make an argument for the federal government to take on something, and in general, it should stay out of all these issues, including marriage, I think. But if a state, so I guess the missing piece of this discussion is I think the ideas of Emile Durkheim, which have been really influential on me. Durkheim wrote this, one of his most famous books, his book called Suicide, in which he analyzed the suicide statistics in Europe and found that basically the more people were bound into a society, the less they killed themselves. People were single, higher suicide rate. People were married but no children, higher suicide rate than people were married with. The more you're bound in, actually, even though we say we want liberty and freedom, we actually need some constraint. And libertarians probably need less constraint than others, but they then want to make a world that's very unconstraining. And I think a lot of people who are at the other end of this Bentham caste dimension, a lot of people would feel dizzy and disoriented and despairing in a world created by libertarians.
One final question before we open it up. Do you have any, you talked about society becoming desacralized and this revulsion against impure things is diminishing in the West and United States. Either, do you have any predictions on the future of the culture war? Is the purity discussed, you know, aspect of politics, and is that what's going to happen there?
Yeah. So these sorts of rich, thick, binding moralities that moralize food and sex and all that's only possible when you have little moral diversity and you have a long period of cultural stability. Then things tend to thicken up. America had a very long period from about 1914 to the 1960s with very low immigration, and there was a kind of a consolidation around a sort of a Protestant identity. And there were some very good things that came out of that. Some analysis of civility and incivility in Congress shows that it's in part diversity. You don't have a sense of a shared moral community. There's more strife. So there are some good things to be said about having a shared culture. Now, there are also very good things to be said about diversity and immigration, and that's the way we're going, clearly. And the Republicans have realized that they basically lost the battle over these social issues. And the reason they lost the battle is that the demographics are just taking care of it. So since the power base of the Republican Party since the 80s has been especially white Southern Protestants, and that is a shrinking demographic, East Asians and, well, of course, Latinos could be very good candidates. They're Catholic, they're religious, so they could be good allies. I could imagine possibly the Republicans somehow luring in Latinos and then they could revive this, but that's not likely to happen. Short of that, the enormous and growing moral diversity makes these kind of thick, rich codes increasingly untenable. And I believe that the culture war has now shifted radically. It was, especially in the 80s and 90s, it was over all these social issues, over sex, over capital punishment, corporal punishment, spanking your kids, burning the flag, all that social stuff. And all of that actually is purity, even burning the flag. Turns out we have data. People who don't like, who object to burning the flag for free speech purposes, you'd think it was issues of group loyalty that predict it, but it's not. It's actually disgust, because they treat the flag as not just a piece of cloth, but there's a sacred essence to the flag. Since the Tea Party, which has united libertarians and social conservatives, that unity has forced them to downplay the social issues because libertarians do not agree with the social conservatives. So for a variety of reasons, that alliance plus the increasing demographic diversity, the Republicans can't possibly revive this purity stuff, this anti-gay stuff. It's a losing ticket, and it'll be more losing every year.
Just one final thing. But I'm going to happen from the other side, though, where Greens now have their own purity obsession with organic food and pesticides, and is that where purity is going to end up going?
Yeah, that's a good point. I've painted it as though it's conservatives who do all the purity stuff. Liberals do it too. But it's commonly joked that conservatives are always heavily moralizing sex and telling you what you can't do. But my God, just try to order breakfast with somebody who's on the far left. How do they treat the workers? Was it fair trade styrofoam? I mean, everything. It's so, yeah.